Joining us now on El Paso Primetime is a wonderful author. If you've never heard of Christopher Moore, I'm about to introduce you to a guy who writes like I've never read before in my life. First off, Christopher, welcome to El Paso Primetime.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
You've written 15 novels. Your latest endeavor is one called Secondhand Souls. It reminds me, as I read through this book several times since we've received copies, there's a series, and I can't remember what cable series it is, but it's always about, you know, these funky little shops in the Bay Area, and you're always looking. These people come into the shop looking for all these little gadgets and whatnot that deals with death and dying and everything. And your book reminds me so much of having one of those little secondhand shops, especially your protagonist, Alphonse Rivera, a guy who dabbled in homicide for about 15 years and decided to get out of the business only to open up a shop that dealt with it. That's a weird twist. How did you wind up with this?
Well, you know, I started the book that preceded this, A Dirty Job, which I wrote like 10 years ago, was the idea of a guy who was sort of a little bit of a hypochondriac and a beta male, which I define as a guy who sort of makes his way by imagining dangers and avoiding them. And he gets the job of being deaf, and he runs it out of a secondhand store in North Beach, which is a neighborhood in San Francisco. So I set up this whole mythology of these guys who move human souls by reselling objects, whether it's books or records or whatever. And so when we started with Secondhand Souls, we see Alphonse Rivera, who, as you said, was a homicide detective, but he's been tapped to be one of these soul merchants, and he's in his used bookstore, and he just hasn't been doing his job as the person who's supposed to move souls from one person to another. And sort of the whole precept of the book is that that's the problem, is that there's a lot of these souls in San Francisco that have not been cared for, and they're lost. And that's how we sort of take off into the book.
It's a curious way to look into the mythology of death and the mythology of the soul. And some people would argue and say it's not a mythology. That's a reality in terms of reincarnation and whatnot. So my sense is that you've done quite a lot of research in this kind of field, number one, and I've had a chance to finally obtain most of your other pieces of work. And, God, you're a phenomenal writer, first off. You tap into my soul, which has always been haphazard anyway, and somehow you have a way of writing, a very calculated way of making your characters seem as though they're haphazard when in reality they're not.
Well, I think that, you know, you and I may have that in common, but I think it makes for a more interesting story when you have somebody who you can relate to, you know. And I always feel like I'm sort of on the edge of skidding out of control. There's been a couple of times when writers very graciously have commented on my books that he is a writer completely in control of his material, and I thought, boy, I've never had that sense. I always feel like I'm sort of driving down a ski slope in a Volkswagen with bald tires about ready to crash into a tree, and I'm just trying not to crash. And I pretty much go through life that way. And so my characters do too, and maybe, you know, all of us who I think are somewhat flawed relate to that. And then you put somebody what would be the term, a situation of strain, and they step up, you know. So maybe the idea is that we all maybe have a little bit of character inside of us that we just have to summon when the situation calls for it. And I put characters in a situation that calls for it, and maybe that's why you relate to it, and I relate to it, and a lot of people who think, well, maybe I'm not exactly in control of everything relate to it.
Yeah. Well, see, you know, the beautiful part about your book, and I love the way that you've written around it rather than to go head first into it. Most people would argue that having a soul is a religious experience. The way you've handled it, though, is that a soul is an entity from a different dimension that needs to be returned from one end to another, and that's why you have vessels like this character who comes in with his two dogs, including Lazarus, and looking for a tidbit. And he's not getting it from the guy, right? But this is the soul who has to do the dirty work, is actually taking the souls and placing them where they need to go.
Right. It sort of falls on the Buddhist precept that we are our soul, sort of what they determine as the soul, the eternal part of us, gets represented with lessons we didn't get in the last life. And until you get through all the lessons, sort of like a good way to look at it in metaphor is to say, you know, if you didn't learn how to read by second grade, you're going to have to do second grade again. Uh-huh. And that's sort of the way the Buddhists see the progression of the soul, is that, you know, if your soul didn't get this part, you have to do that again and through another life and another body. All I do is add mechanics to it. You just, well, here's the baton, and that baton might be a pair of sneakers or a used book or a CD, and that carries the soul from person to person. And then the person is the vessel for the soul moving forward. It's not completely irreconcilable with the idea of the immortal soul in the Christian religion, or it's just a different way of looking at how that which is personal to a human being, that spirit that's in each of us, ascends to be part of everything. You know, and that in someone's faith might be heaven, and in another person's faith it might be all one with all things, which is the same way that God is described in the Christian religion. So it's not completely irreconcilable with many faiths, but for my purposes of storytelling, it's much easier to use the Tibetan Buddhist way of looking at the way the soul migrates, because they're very active in, you know, you have to have a monk there to help your soul move from this life into the next life, and there's a 49-day period in which that must happen. And so secondhand souls is sort of the physical getting souls from one place to the other, and when they get lost, which is what happens in the book, then everything kind of goes awry, and we need to get them back together, or the forces of darkness will rise.
To me, it's a literary version of the Twilight Zone, to be honest with you. It feels like that. It's on the one hand, it's very campy, but on the other hand, there's a lesson in life that every page tells you this is how it's going to be. If you don't deal with it, I mean, you suck. You know?
Well, I think that's actually a flattering comparison. I learned to right from those guys that wrote the stories that the Twilight Zone was taken from. And one of the things about writing comedy is that you can sort of disarm these really scary monsters of you know, being terminally ill or grieving or dying, and you can get people to look at subjects they wouldn't look at. Now, the Twilight Zone did it sort of with with science fiction and horror, supernatural horror. I do it with a little bit of supernatural horror, but also with comedy, and to say, okay, you know, we don't lose our sense of humor when we get sick or when we lose somebody. We just all get really afraid we're going to say the wrong thing, and sometimes that alienates the person that needs you most at the time, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of the underlying purpose of it. The main thing is to entertain people and make them laugh, but maybe defang those scary monsters a little bit.
I like the way that you write. It's very refreshing. It's not forced. It's so natural. It seems like it just flows from your brain into the computer or wherever you happen to be writing. Could be on the back of a napkin and then you transfer it later. But the way you compose the body of the story and let it flow and let it breathe really does captivate my interest.
Oh, well, that's nice of you to say. Because I write comedy, actually a lot of it does get put on napkins and plugged in. I think comedy is reactive. In other words, you have to have a sort of a stimulus, and then my default setting is humor, so I'll see something, I think, well, and my reaction to it will be funny, and then I'll plug it into the book later. So, you know, used to actually be, you know, cocktail napkins and stuff like that, and, you know, matchbooks. Now I don't go anywhere without a little notebook and a pen with me, and then I plug it in later. So it's a little bit of craft, and it's a little bit of piecing things together, simply because the comedy doesn't always come to you. What's funny doesn't always come to you when you sit down and look at a blank page. It'll often come to me when I'm out and about walking around in the world. So your perception that it's a little bit of both is absolutely right, and I'm glad it looks smooth, because when I'm putting it together, it doesn't feel like it's going smoothly.
As I look at your life, and I read your books, one thing that hits me is that it seems as though humor has always run in your family. I know it doesn't in mine, and so humor really doesn't come naturally to me. I have to work at it. But in your life, it seems like the way that you write, it seems like you've drawn on your childhood memories in order to make this happen.
Well, I was raised, my dad was a highway patrolman, and emergency workers, you know, with EMTs and nurses, and trauma nurses and cops, firemen, they tend to, in my experience, develop this sense of humor that's a little bit dark as a defense mechanism because of all the trauma that they witness in their day-to-day lives, in their jobs. And I grew up with that. I mean, that was, you know, how my dad talked at the dinner table. He just had this little bit of this edge of dark humor, and all the guys that were around, you know, his cop friends, they were that way as well. So I think that that was my way of growing up looking at the world. I thought you were all supposed to crack wise when something happened, whether it was dark or whether it was funny, or you'd find the funny part in it just to sort of protect yourself. And so it was logical for me to put it into my work. I thought I was writing horror stories when I started, and I read them at a writer's conference, and people laughed at them, and I thought, oh, well, I guess that's what I do. And it turns out it is what I do.
Yeah, and it's a great way that you do that. Christopher Moore is our guest this afternoon on El Paso Primetime, and his 15th novel is called Secondhand Souls. He's been on the New York Times bestseller list with A Dirty Job, but you've had quite a number of international bestsellers, Lamb and You Suck, that book. Really, I like that book. I wonder why.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I've had what they call international bestsellers for, I don't know, I think since about my fifth or sixth book, but the last seven have been on the New York Times list, which is sort of, you know, that's the wall you want to get over.
Right.
And I don't know if it speaks to the quality of it. It just means that you found an audience and that people like the work and they're waiting and expecting it. And, you know, that's flattering. And I feel some responsibility to be entertaining and tell a good story. And that's not a bad thing. It doesn't mean anything as far as, you know, the quality of the work. It can be crap and still be on the list. I'm hoping my stuff's not crap.
No, it isn't. To be honest with you, Christopher, I think what it is that your writing is so refreshing, and it gets us away from the tragedy of life that has been befalling us of late. And when I read your books, I feel as though you've just lifted a boulder off my shoulders for the day, and, you know, read a chapter, read this, read that, go through work, you know, and, find time in the afternoon to read another chapter. It's that kind of a book.
Well, good. It's nice to hear that. You can't really hope to do that when you're sitting down to write them, but it's great to hear that they affect people that way, that particularly these books about death and dying, where people have written to me and when they were in really difficult times in their life and said, this lightened my load a little bit. A writer can't ask for more than that. I mean, I can't be more flattered than to hear that my book eased the way for somebody in any way, you know, even if it just gave them a smile among a very difficult time.
Your book comes at a real good time, too, because traditionally along the border on November 1st, we celebrate Dia de los Muertos and Day of the Dead.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so this is a great book to have in your collection and to read practically on that day, because it will put a smile on everyone's face, I think.
Yeah, I think it actually opens on the Day of the Dead. I seems to me if it's the Rivera, because he is Hispanic, he right. refers to that in one of the first two or three chapters, I think. It's been a while since I've looked at the draft. I may have cut that part out.
No, it's in there. It's in the first chapter.
It's okay.
In the first chapter. It's a great introduction into the shop. And I wish I could remember the TV series that this reminds me of, because there are two shops, one in New York and one in the Bay Area. It's this little blonde lady that's like about 5'2". She looks like a walking skeleton, and her partner in this TV series is this huge cop-looking guy. Looks like Highway Patrol, like Broderick Crawford is what he looks like. And it's a real series that's on one of the cable channels. Yeah. And so your shop reminds me of this. Spooked, I think, or something like that.
I haven't seen it. I don't watch a whole lot of reality show. But I will tell you that the creatures that are the squirrel people, which inhabit both of these books, I found them in a shop in San Francisco when I was researching A Dirty Job, and I contacted the artist who made them. And basically what they are these very elaborately costumed creatures that are about 14 inches tall, made out of different animal parts, like raccoon hands and bobcat skull and chicken feet and so forth like that. And I contacted the woman that made them, and I said, can I use these in a book as characters? And she said, I'd be flattered. So, you know, we've sort of become friends, and she's made a couple of incarnations of the characters for me. They're in, like, my profile pictures on Facebook and Twitter, too. But they, you know, it's interesting that you would bring up the shop thing, because that's really where some of the characters started, was a visual artist. She's a costume artist, and she couldn't afford to make full-size costumes out of this expensive material, so she would make miniature ones and then put these little weird creatures inside of them. And so it, each feeds its own. I don't think they're one of the shops on the shows, but it's definitely there's definitely those little weird curio shops that inhabit this city for sure.
Oh man, that's great. I wish we had more time, but I know we're up against the clock because you've got a lot of other people that need to talk to you, Christopher. But I have to tell you, first off, congratulations on a wonderful job on this book, Secondhand Souls.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it, Dennis.
And what I'd like to do is I'd like to get a hold of you later on, and let's sit and talk about death and dying in a humoristic sort of a way. How's that sound?
Happy to do it.
Wonderful. Christopher, have a wonderful day. Thank you so much for joining us on El Paso Primetime.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me. Take care.
You too.